call the subcommittee to order, please. Today is February the 6th. The time is 1:32. And we have with us Representative Munoz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Stoltz, Representative Thompson, Representative T. Wilson, and myself, Representative Osterman. And I'll chair today. Representative Newman has other commitments that he had to go take care of. We have one item on our agenda today, and that'll be bringing up the Division of Juvenile Justice, and it'll be presented by, I think, Barb Hengem. Does that sound correct? If you'll join us at the table, and if you want to bring the commissioner with you or back up, that's perfectly fine. He's indicated that you're on your own. Oh, no, you do have backup. That's good. All right. So Representative Guerra has just joined us. If you will introduce yourselves, and then when you testify, whichever one's going to testify do the most, when your partner speaks up, she needs to identify herself during the record, because both women, they will have a hard time discerning on the record who you are. So with that, Barb?
Okay, great.
All yours.
Thank you.
And we also have a policy here of not taking questions till after your presentation is over, so that we get through your presentation.
Sounds good. I sat way over here, so I couldn't accidentally button.
I know. You got to raise your hand.
I don't see.
Except for now. Except for now.
Ignore him if he raises his hand. Same thing goes on this side as well, by the way. All right, Barb, it's up to you. Go ahead.
All right. For the record, my name is Barbara Hengem, and I'm the director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. I'd like to introduce also Jana Hurd, my admin operations manager, who will be presenting with me. And also with me is Karen Forrest and Rob Wood, who are deputy directors of the division, and Tony Newman, our legislative liaison, is here as well. During my presentation this afternoon, I hope to provide you an overview of the Division of Juvenile Justice, our mission, core services, description of the services we provide across the state, and some of our recent accomplishments and challenges. A dear UPIC friend of mine told me once that people can't hear my words unless they know who I am. So I'm briefly going to tell you a few things about me. I began working with gang-involved kids in Chicago in 1979, worked at Hennepin County Juvenile Center for a couple of years from 81 to 83, and then moved to Alaska. Was hired in 1983 at McLaughlin Youth Center as a youth counselor one. I was superintendent there for many years and have now been director of the division since 2010. It's my 30th year working for and with juvenile offenders in Alaska. And I've been blessed to have a career that is both fulfilling and rewarding. I'm very pleased to present to you today. If you're looking at the budget overview book, we begin on page 237. If you're looking at your handout, our first slide shows you the mission of the Division of Juvenile Justice. Our mission is to hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior, promote the safety and restoration of victims and communities, and assist offenders and their families in developing skills to prevent crime. Our restorative justice mission was set in statute in 1998 and requires us to view juvenile crime through three different lenses: that of the youth who committed the crime, the victim of the crime, and the community the crime occurred. There are three main tenets of restorative justice, and their accountability, community protection, and competency development. We work with youthful offenders to understand they're responsible to repair the harm they have caused. We work with victims to ensure they are part of the process, and we work with communities to find solutions to juvenile crime. It's no small order, but I'm proud to be the director of a division with that focus. The Division of Juvenile Justice has five core services that form the basis of our work. The first one is intake investigation. During fiscal year 12, DJJ probation officers located in 16 probation offices around the state responded to 3,859 reports of juvenile crime. This number represents a 9.4% decline in the number of referrals from last year. Some of our referrals included multiple offenses, and some juveniles were involved in multiple referrals. The most common referral continues to be for a misdemeanor crime against property. So a taking or destroying something that doesn't belong to a person. Usually caused by a 15 or 16 year old boy who's likely to have problems in school, problems with his family, likely has a mental health diagnosis, and if he was your neighbor, you'd probably think he's heading for trouble. Juvenile probation officers respond to law enforcement reports by conducting intake investigations, determining legal sufficiency to take further action. They complete detention screenings, initiate formal court action against the juvenile offender, contact victims, provide formal community supervision, and assist in reentry into the community following release from the secure facilities. 69% of the referrals to DJJ last year were diverted from the formal justice system to what we call an informal response, such as youth court. In Alaska, we have a very successful youth court program, and they serve as models for other states and jurisdictions. 465 cases were diverted to one of our 12 youth courts last year, which is about 12% of our total DJJ referrals. In addition, youth courts were also referred 164 district court cases. Our second core service is probation services, and this includes supervision and monitoring of youth on probation. During FY12, 1,429 youth were on probation supervision around the state. Probation officers work with arrested youth, their families, the victim, and determine the most appropriate response and supervision. Youth are screened in 8 areas of risk and need using the Youth Level of Service Case Management Inventory, which helps to guide the probation officer's recommendations. Based on risks, needs, and strengths, some youth require significant intervention and some less. As Commissioner Sturr tells us, get the right service for the right person at the right time, and that's what the youth level of service is all about for us. Short-term detention is our next core service, and we have 8 facilities located around the state that provide short-term detention services. We have facilities in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Palmer, Kenai, Bethel, Ketchikan, and Nome. Last year, these facilities admitted 1,323 youth with an average length of stay of 24 days. We continue to ask our facilities to use their resources to the maximum benefit of the communities they serve. It's expensive for the state of Alaska to have facilities in different parts of the state, but the legislature has made decision over the years, and research supports this effort, that keeping kids closer to home in smaller facilities results in better outcomes. My Anchorage office is located at McLaughlin Youth Center. And last Saturday morning when I went to work for a few hours, I arrived and talked to a young man who had just showed up for community work service. There were 2 teenage girls and a boy and their parents coming in for a 4-hour course called Thinking Patterns, helping early offenders understand what they've done. There were kids leaving to do community service and kids going on pass. Our facilities are really hubs for activity regarding juvenile justice and kids and success and helping them make better choices. This year, our detention facilities are averaging a 75% capacity rate. 5 of our facilities are also now offering community detention programs that allow appropriate youth to spend part of the day with us and then go home and sleep in their own beds. Youth involved in they are involved in restorative justice and skill building activities while still having to be challenged with the choices that brought them to our attention in the first place. Parents love those programs, and community safety is enhanced by them. Our fourth core service is court-ordered institutional treatment. The most serious juvenile offenders in our communities are court-ordered to receive rehabilitation services in one of our 4 treatment programs located in Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Bethel. 92 youth were admitted to our treatment programs last year. Our treatment programs are currently operating at 85% capacity. The kids in these programs are the most difficult to serve with the most complex issues. These are the kids whose behavior demonstrate that they need more than the community can provide to ensure the safety of everyone. We provide evidence-based interventions, such as aggression replacement training, that focuses on teaching chronically aggressive adolescents social skills, moral reasoning, and anger management. We provide educational services, substance abuse treatment, and family work. We want the youth to have the best chance of success when they return to your communities. We also know the critical role of preparing youth for successful reentry and release, and I'm proud of the role that the Alaska Division of Juvenile Justice has had in leading reentry programs nationally. Underlying all of the other core services is juvenile offender skill development. Just as you would inquire about a nephew you hadn't seen for a while, you wouldn't ask, have you been arrested? But instead you'd ask, how is school? How is work? Where are you living? Are you doing well? We need the youth in our care to be contributing citizens of our state, not just out of jail. This can mean helping youth learn how to manage their anger, understand and manage their response to the trauma in their lives, learn about the impact of drugs and alcohol, learn about the impact of their crimes on victims and communities. But they also need an education, job skills, and to understand how to be successful as an adult. We don't want the youth referred to us to commit more crimes, but that isn't enough. It's just not enough to focus on what they're not supposed to do. So we accomplish this significantly through partnerships and collaboration across all of our community services. This map shows the distribution of where our cases come from or came from last year. As you can see, the majority come from the Anchorage area. We also have a significant number, about 24% came from the northern region, 20% from south central region, and 14% from southeast. Next. As I mentioned, the division has 16 probation offices located across the state, and they serve as the point of intake for law enforcement reports related to crimes committed by youth under the age of 18. We manage 8 juvenile facilities around the state, and as I described, they provide 2 types of service. All 8 provide detention services for youth just arrested for serious delinquent behavior, and 4 of them provide long-term treatment services. This chart is a visual illustration of how youth move through our system and the variety and options that our staff utilize to ensure that the right youth is given the right service at the right time. As you look at this chart, I realize it looks complicated. And as I was preparing my presentation for you, I was trying to think of a way to simplify this work that we do. Since we're part of the Department of Health and Social Services, I'll use the healthcare system as my analogy. In many ways, the arrest of a youth in one of our communities is the symptom of a problem with that youth. The juvenile probation officers who receive that law enforcement report are the primary care physicians who screen and assess the presenting symptoms and attempt to treat the behavior in the least invasive approach to cure the problem. At times, the youth needs to be detained in one of our 8 detention centers that can be likened to emergency rooms in the healthcare analogy. They provide critical services in our communities at crisis times of serious delinquent behavior. There, the symptoms are stabilized, the youth's risks, needs, and strengths are assessed, and through the court process, the appropriate treatment or services are determined. Due to the extreme needs of some youth, the healthcare equivalent of hospitalization, or in our case, we call it institutionalization, is required. There, we provide comprehensive services to address the issues presented by the offender. Educational needs, substance abuse treatment, family services, help the youth learn new ways of looking at the choices they make. However, just as a doctor visit or hospital stay can give me medication, treat my issues, it's what I do when I leave that will determine whether I stay well or get well. And really, when kids leave our system, it's that same challenge. Do they take the treatment we give them, or do they go on with their same bad habits? They do leave our custody with an understanding of the impact of their crime on their families, victims, and community, new understandings of their potential, and hopefully more skills. But truly, the success of the juvenile justice system is based on how well they do when they leave our care, not just on how well we manage their behavior while they're with us. As you can see from the organizational chart, there are three main parts of our division: probation services, facilities, and central office. We have 484 permanent full-time and part-time staff. One point I would like just to point out to you: among other juvenile justice systems nationwide and among other state agencies in Alaska, the Division of Juvenile Justice is recognized for the longevity of staff at all levels of our system. As an example, the 26 senior managers in our division have a combined 473 years of state of Alaska employment, or an average of 18 years. If you've worked for DJJ for 10 or 15 years, we consider you just getting started. The longevity has allowed us to be a system that continues to focus on moving forward with initiatives and research-based improvements, because we're not continuously hiring staff, training them, or developing new managers. Two major accomplishments I'd like to share with you are under the broader topics of data-driven decisions, and the other is trauma-informed care. As Commissioner Struer shared with you during his presentation, our department and our division have been focused on innovation and change to ensure that we use our valuable resources to deliver quality services and that those services result in desired results. As our state dollars shrink, I appreciate the difficult choices ahead that will require careful scrutiny of every dollar asked for and spent. We're preparing the Division of Juvenile Justice to be able to provide the information we will need to work with you to make the difficult choices that are in our future. I'll give you a few examples of how we're using data this year to improve our system. First example, by reviewing information in our Juvenile Offender Management Information System, which we call JOMIS, we determined that we needed to focus training and quality assurance on ensuring our staff have the skills they need to deliver a validated assessment tool that is used at the beginning of a youth's time with us. It's called the Youth Level of Service Case Management Inventory. Unlike when I started my career, this research-based assessment can now tell us where to focus our interventions on things that make the biggest difference for a youth and his or her family. Our probation staff have now all been trained or retrained, our quality assurance process is established, and I'm looking forward to the outcomes improving. Example two, since 2004, the Division of Juvenile Justice has participated in a nationally recognized quality improvement program called Performance-Based Standards, or PBS, that monitors services to the youth in our facilities and works on improving the conditions of confinement. Twice a year, our eight facilities report data and are measured for compliance on over 100 best practice standards. Each Alaska facility is compared to facilities in 28 other states. In recent years, the PBS standards have influenced our division's policy development in the areas of safety security, suicide prevention, transitional services, and health and mental health screening and assessment. Our most recent data from October of 2012 shows Alaska DJJ facilities are excelling in these areas. Alaska uses fewer physical and mechanical restraints than the national average. Alaska has a higher rate of timely screening completion for mental health, and suicide. Alaska has on average fewer fights and assaults in our facilities than that of other PBS-involved states. And Alaska rates high above the field average in kids attaining higher math and reading scores upon release from our secure facilities. We're very proud of those statistics. A third example for you with our data is something we refer to as YODA, which is the Youth Court Data Application. As I've discussed, we need to ensure that our services and the outcomes of the youth in all parts of our system are tracked to ensure that our dollars are buying the results we want. Fiscal year 2012 was the first full year of data collection in the Youth Offender Data Application for the Youth Courts of Alaska. This application, created and maintained by our department, allows all 12 youth courts across the state to contribute data to a central database. Previously, each youth court's data was different, making comparison and long-term tracking impossible. During FY12, the system continued to evolve and improve based on feedback from the youth court directors. During FY13, we hope to add the ability for users to run real-time reports on demand. And finally, as I've mentioned, and you may have seen in the budget overview book, the number of youth being referred to DJJ has continued to decline for many years. Our facilities are no longer overcrowded, as they were for many years, and based on long-term trend data, we've had the chance to realign some of our units at our largest facility, McLaughlin Youth Center, to better meet our current needs. So we've combined two boys' detention units, or two treatment units that were both operating at about 50% capacity, and we were able to separate our girls' unit, which would have girls' detention and girls' long-term treatment, into two separate units. We've already seen the quality of our girls' program improve, and our boys' program is being better utilized. As a system, we continue to work for being nimble and responsive to change that we see, and we are continuing to do that. The second major accomplishment I want to talk with you about is trauma-informed care. In my more than 30 years of working in juvenile justice, two of the most significant topics in research that have impacted our views and understanding of what causes delinquency are brain development research and the impact of adverse childhood experiences and trauma. Regarding the first, just briefly, research has shown us that the developing brain isn't complete by age 5, which is what I learned in my undergraduate psychology classes in the late 1970s. The area of the brain we know now to last fully develop is the frontal lobe, and it controls people's long-range thinking, impulsiveness, all those teenage things that we know about. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has had 3 significant rulings in the last few years that reinforce that. I'm going to quote from one of them. The justice wrote, "Youth is more than a chronological fact. It's a time of immaturity, irresponsibility, impetuousness, and recklessness." Thank goodness for all of us that the inevitability of growth and the ability to learn and change that's the foundation of rehabilitation, restorative justice, and the juvenile justice system. The second significant research finding is the impact of trauma and adverse childhood experiences on youthful offenders. Research now shows us conclusively that youth who have had multiple exposures to violence or victimization are at a higher risk for delinquency, mental health problems, behavioral problems, and substance abuse. A few years ago, we began a pilot program at McLaughlin Youth Center on a boys' detention unit and a boys' treatment unit, and an approach of trauma-informed care. These were the two units at the facility that had the highest incidence of restraint and seclusion and isolation. We've learned that based on the research that youth exposed to trauma, they actually have physiological differences in their brains. They go 0 to 60 really fast. They're in a fright and flight mode. And it impacts their response to the world. And trauma-informed care teaches us how to use that information to create a better environment around them. We have an improved understanding of the connection between the trauma history, their current behaviors, and their developmental problems, issues. And we emphasize now more on the youth's emotional and behavioral control through coping skills and emphasize positive relationships. Since implementing trauma-informed care, we've seen a significant reduction in resident restraints in both of these units, which means they're safer for residents and staff. And we're providing improved conditions of confinement for the youth in our care. We're now expanding our pilot to 4 more of our facilities and their adjoining probation offices. And with your support, we hope to provide the necessary training and support to all of our facilities within the next 2 years. Next. I was asked in my presentation to talk about our FY 2013 funding that we received. And we received funding in 2 main areas and then a continued funding in a third. The first one was support for 5 new PCNs to meet the minimum national standards for would allow 2 graveyard shift per unit at our facilities. For many years, the legislature was asked to get our facilities up to minimum standards, and these were the last 5 PCNs that were required to meet those. These positions weren't a luxury, but they really were meeting minimum staffing patterns. Also, last year, through the support of the Mental Health Trust, you approved the MTAR funding to hire a mental health clinician four position that serves as a clinical director for our division. We employ 13 master's or PhD level clinicians that serve all of our facilities and some of our probation offices. As we continue to refine our programs for our mentally ill youth, we realize that statewide oversight of our valuable clinicians was needed to more fully utilize this resource. As the Mental Health Trust CEO Jeff Jesse shared with you in his presentation, 44% of the youth in DJJ have a serious mental health diagnosis and are considered trust beneficiaries. We continue to focus on improving services for this group of high-need youth. Also, last year, you approved ongoing MTAR funding for the DJJ Rural Specialist, who works closely with staff and rural partners throughout the state to improve the outcomes of our Alaska Native youth. We've seen significant progress in our work with rural communities and tribal organizations through this effort. I don't have a slide for the next few things, but division challenges is an area that we were also asked to talk with you about, and I'm going to share three of those. The first one is healthcare cost containment. Youth in our facilities are not eligible for federal Medicaid due to federal restrictions on youth and adults in locked correctional facilities. Alaska statute, however, requires that we provide medical care for the youth in our care. Paying for the rising costs of medical services continues to be a challenge for our budget. We've been working on this issue for the past several years, and recently Commissioner Sturr has given us some creative ideas for us to explore. We will definitely continue to work on this issue and hope to get a handle on it soon. The second challenge we have is continue to expand collaboration with our community partners and other systems. As I mentioned, the success of the youth in our care is determined by how they do after they leave our services. And much of the work we do to ensure their success is connecting them with services in our communities. We will continue to develop and expand partnerships with the Department of Labor, Education, Behavioral Health, community and tribal partners. Recently with AHFC and others, there's a lot that we still need to continue to do to really tie our kids into those services. And the third area of improvement is continuing to push for improvements in our five performance measures. A few years ago, we identified five areas to focus our efforts on that we believed would see the biggest improvement in the youth in our care. These five areas are youth with substance abuse issues, youth with behavioral health diagnosis, Alaska Native youth, education and vocational needs of youth, and our overall recidivism, which we know is an important measure of our success. We continue to hold ourselves accountable to progress in these areas to ensure we don't just get caught up in the day-to-day work, but also continue to move our system forward. So our 2014 increment requests. Our first one is $400,000 for medical services for the youth in our juvenile justice facilities. As I described this need, our kids are not eligible for federal Medicaid, and the price of these services continues to go up. And I definitely appreciate your support with that increment. The second one is $150,000 to continue to expand trauma-informed care to all eight of our facilities. We're requesting $75,000 in GF and $75,000 MTAR. Third and fourth increments are continued funding for items that are also funded by MTAR. One is the mental health clinician oversight for our clinical services, and the other is our rural coordinator. The last area of the presentation we're asked to discuss with you is our new performance measures. As you know, we're all being educated about results-based budgeting, and we're on a steep learning curve to apply these principles to our work. Our new departmental priorities provide a focus for the division, and we are particularly well represented in health and wellness across the lifespan, and safe and responsible individuals, families, and communities. Our efficiency and effectiveness measures will be closely tied to the recidivism of our youth after they receive our services, and also the cost of care in different parts of our system. As mentioned in our accomplishments section, we're working as a division to ensure that we'll have the data necessary to inform the conversations with you, the legislators, that you'll have with us in the years to come. I understand a simple description of results-based budgeting is what is the bang for the buck that the state of Alaska is getting from the money spent. So for us, we're working to be able to provide the detail, but what do our various services cost? How do they vary in different parts of the state? What are the outcomes of the different types of youth going through our system? And how do the costs and services, how do the costs of the services and outcomes of the youth give us discussion points about the how the state spends money? One day in the future, as the state revenues decline, and a juvenile justice director is sitting in front of you, sharing the costs associated with providing valuable juvenile justice services across the state, you'll be looking to save some money. And the really hard decisions will not be about the money or about our effectiveness and efficiency measures, but it's going to be about values. What does it cost for a youth in a small rural DJJ facility versus a large urban one? Do we believe and are we willing to pay for the costs of keeping kids closer to home and closer to their families? What are the unforeseen costs of taking a rural youth and providing their treatment hundreds of miles from home? Should we invest in the families of youth who commit crimes? As an Alaskan who plans to live in Alaska the rest of my life, I look forward to robust conversations about budget and values. I'm encouraging our DJJ senior managers and all staff to consider these questions now. We're working diligently to have the data to inform the conversation so the most appropriate, difficult decisions can be made. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today.
Thank you, Barb. Appreciate your presentation. One thing that jumps into my mind, and that is deals with, it appears as, it, and I don't know much about your division, I'll be very candid, but it appears as if it's youth that are in trouble that come to see you.
Yeah.
And so is there a segment that addresses trying to keep them from coming? And I mean, if a parent comes to you and says, I've got a child that's smoking marijuana and I want to get him some help, mm-hmm. does he get involved in your division or do you send him to mental health or to wherever?
We get those calls every day in our facilities and probation offices, and we do two things with them. We do provide, we'll talk to parents, give them ideas and suggestions, hear out what they have to say. At times we have, a parent will bring in a kid to talk with a probation officer, not in a scared straight way, but in a, just another adult that can talk to the kid about what the choices they're making. We also refer them on to community mental health services. If it's a substance abuse issue, to the services in their community, if it's a mental health issue, or if it's just the family needs somebody to talk to. And a lot of times it's that support. So both, we do both.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. You talked about it, but I didn't hear anything about your recidivism rates. I mean, is there some good results happening from people going through your system?
Yeah, I would love to share that with you. So recidivism rates are apples and oranges across the country. You know, how some systems describe it is different than others. And right now we do not track recidivism of our low-level offenders, so the kids that come in and don't have serious offenses, we don't track them. Only the serious offenders that actually get on formal probation and in our facilities. So that's the group that we're looking at, our serious offenders. And with that group, we track them for 2 years past their release date with us. And our recidivism rate right now, over the last 3 years, it's actually remained fairly consistent, is at 45%.
A follow-up? I've heard some fantastic results from the youth courts and how that they have really had some high statistics of turning kids around. And I think you mentioned that there was only 12% of youth that are sent to a youth court. Is there any way that could be increased since it has such great results?
The kids that go to youth court are those kids that we view as they're usually first-time offenders, and they are we're trying to get the right kid in the right service. So these are kids that probably are lower risk to reoffend, but if you get the right service when they're at that stage, they won't continue on. And so we send everyone we can to them. But kids that have more complicated issues or needs really aren't appropriate for youth courts.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Barb, for being here. On the, just to clarify on the recidivism rates, because it was mentioned several times about how well you do after care, is that, and I know Department of Corrections tracks the data for recidivism rates. The definition is, I think, 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there's a way to do it, and I don't know if there's a way to completely do it, but it seems like it's a fairly good metric to use, even for offenders who are on the lower scales. I just think that's good, valuable data.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, just to also comment on that same question, just how many go from the Department of Juvenile, Division of Juvenile Justice system, and then eventually show up in the Department of Corrections system. And I don't know if there's ways to track a youth offender at 15 all the way through life cycle, but it would be valuable to know, I think. My questions have to do with on the I'm looking at the, you mentioned that the referrals statewide have dropped, it looks like, in FY07, 57 and 9 in 09. In FY12, 38, 59. The graph on 265 shows the average daily populations going from 123 to 88. I mean, these are trend lines that are drastically mm-hmm. reduced over the last few years. And so I guess I guess my question is, why does the budget keep going up?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, we have in our facilities, if we're operating at 50% capacity or 100% capacity, I have to staff it the same. We have minimum staffing levels that are, we are staffed for, our facility, our detention centers right now are at about 75%, treatment units are about 85%, and that fluctuates throughout the year. But as we are, I have full-time employees, and with our countdown one week to, for example, at the Matsu facility, if it's down to 7 kids versus 15, I don't send staff home that week because I have fewer kids. It still requires staffing on each of those shifts, and they are come to work. So there's long-term trends that we can look at to make change, but the short-term we're not. So we are just at the point right now to really be making some changes with our long-term trends. Other than closing a small facility, they are the sizes they are. So at McLaughlin, that's where we're looking at combining units, utilizing our resources differently. But that's the challenge.
And then I have another question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned in the opening that most youth are 15 to 16-year-old misdemeanor property crime charges, but a lot of them have mental health and substance, mm-hmm. potentially mental health substance abuse issues. And I'm just curious to see if you track your health care costs over the same period of time, if there's, if you've seen an impact with more health care dollars. It's a huge thing for Department of Corrections, and they're not requesting a supplemental this year, but, I mean, we've seen $20 million supplementals just for health care and mm-hmm. Department of Corrections.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, and Gianna could explain this more. We've asked for supplementals most of the last several years and have another one in this year as well. Yep. Healthcare cost is the main driver for those.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Walson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the organizational chart.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, can we find out in the director's office what those positions, just briefly, what they do, not today, because
yes.
You just sent them the email. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, all the different regions, and I'm glad to see the numbers going down, but it's hard for me to understand whether or not it's going down equally in the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
Are there more rural issues or urban? You know, is there an easy way, because I don't want you to go through a whole lot, even by regions where you have Anchorage region, you got South Central region, because you name all the places here.
Mm-hmm.
If we could have the number that youth that you have in there, I don't know whether you do a monthly thing or yearly, just so we can kind of get an idea of how it fluctuates. Maybe winter and summer you have, when they're out more. In the summer, maybe we have more problems, just so we can kind of see what the trends are a little more closer than just those broad numbers.
Yeah. Representative Wilson, through the chair, we track that on an annual basis. We could look at trends if you'd like.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. In like 30 seconds, can you just explain? I know maybe 2 years ago, McLaughlin received sort of a best practices award. And can you tell me what that was for?
Sure, Representative Guerra, through the chair. We had, a few years ago, we were recognized for our reentry aftercare program as a promising practice for nationally to identify, they identified programs that are utilizing all the research-based information on how to most successfully transition a kid from a locked, secure facility to the community. And I recently signed a statewide policy on that as well to really expand that statewide.
Thank you. And through the chair. Many of us have heard from this gentleman, legislator from Texas, pretty conservative guy, but was charged with reducing prison costs in Texas. And one of his proposals was sort of very stern, strict probation after somebody leaves so that person knows they're being watched for a while. What's the typical probation period for somebody who leaves McLaughlin, and do you have any proposals that might be able to lessen recidivism through probation?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's part of our best practice work that we do. When kids get out of McLaughlin, those first weeks, some of the months, they have 4 contacts a week with staff that help that transition. So they are closely monitored. We have staff showing up at their school, if they're working, stop at home, they have to come in, provide UAs. We do very intensive aftercare, and that's what we call it, the intensive aftercare model. And then as they demonstrate success, then we ease off. I think it's a key to their success.
Through the chair. Following up on the chair's question on, you know, what we can do to keep children from coming in, or advising families on how to make sure that children don't come back. You know, I guess there are those who come in from their own families, and there are those who come into McLaughlin because they were in state custody first. And I guess, do you have any percentage or estimated percentage as to what percent of your population in juvenile justice comes in through the foster care system?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we had a study done several years ago, and I can't remember offhand what that was, but we did a one-day snapshot of our kids and looked at how many of them had been in foster care or had OCS involvement, and I could get to that. I don't remember offhand what that was, though. So.
Okay.
And it was a high number.
I expected that. And then through the chair. And I know you're thinking forwards and backwards, both what you can do to prevent recidivism and what you've learned that might keep kids from coming into the system in the first place. And so the only thing that I think we might be able to control is what you might be able to do to get kids from coming in the first place. And then you can only work with other state agencies, so that's kids in foster care, I guess. Do you have any recommendations or observations on what we might be able to do better to keep kids from state custody from coming in?
Representative, through the chair, as you could tell, I'm a big proponent of the adverse childhood experiences research. And we know through the work that we've done in trauma-informed care with our pilot sites at McLaughlin that if you involve the kids in that, teach them about what they've been through. Teach them about their own response to their environment. Teach them how to modulate their own behavior. It makes a significant difference. And that research demonstrates that just talking to a person that has had this series of adverse childhood experiences is a therapeutic intervention. And so I think the more we can talk about that with our kids in foster care, kids that are referrals to OCS or wherever, is that will be beneficial to them. That's what the research shows. And so I am a proponent of talking to all our kids. We screen all of our kids now coming in for trauma and help them understand the impact of their trauma on their lives.
And just finally, Mr. Chair.
Final.
And then there's the intervention in terms of talking to kids about their experiences. Harder to do in natural families because you don't really have contact with them before their children come in. But Do you know in the foster care system if we're doing that, you know, as much as we should be able to or could be able to be doing?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I'm not familiar. I'm not sure what we do, but I know as a department, our Division of Public Health has got some wonderful brochures about trauma and the brain development, and I hand those out everywhere I go to families. And I think it's educating people about that, educating our communities about the importance of that with kids.
Thanks.
Representative Nijman.
Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at my notes from a couple days ago when we had the Office of Child Services here, and sort of following on the line of Representative Guerra's questioning, 1,900 kids in foster care, 1,200 are age 5 and less, 61% are Alaskan Natives. So I wanted to put that into form a question. On page 3 of your presentation, in terms of referrals, if I look at the yellow or the green and the red, the 20 and the 24, that's 44% mm-hmm. of this entire circle. I mean, what percentage of the kids that you deal with, get to the chase here, is Alaska Native kids?
Representative Edwin, through the chair, we have about a third of our kids are Alaska Native. So they're way overrepresented based on the population of the state.
If I could ask a separate question then. Seems the more that I learn, what little I know about our social services or criminal justice system in general, the more everything points back to childhood trauma. And just looking at some of your comments, you said in the last 30 years or so, learning about the development of the brain and adverse childhood experiences and so forth, and violence and victimization and things like that. Kind of a silly question, but will there ever be technology down the road, if maybe there isn't today, where you'll be able to, look at these frontal lobes or the brains and really tell, incorporate that in your screening process, so you know from sort of a medical standpoint whether somebody, some young person has gone through this kind of a trauma beforehand, and you know, if in fact the imprint is so, indelible, I guess. And a growing brain.
Representative Edwin, through the chair, you know, I have been doing this a long time. So when I started, you know, we had carbon paper and wrote things, and who would have ever thought that I'd be doing a PowerPoint presentation on a computer? So do I think that's possible? Well, yes, I think there's. I mean, if you can imagine it, I think it's possible.
So, just my follow-up is that with all that we're learning about the formative stages of the brain. We're slowly moving in that direction to be able to better understand it, more so than just the risk assessment processes that you use now.
Representative Munoz.
Last year, I attended a dinner that was given out at the Johnson Youth Center, and one thing that struck me was how the kids. They really wanted to succeed, and how success was something that probably was not that common in their lives. And so I'm wondering, when they get out, you said that you have regular counselor visits with them after they're released. But is there anything beyond that to get them connected with people in the community that can model positive behavior, trying to get them involved in positive opportunities where they can be successful? And I think that's a challenging question, but I think there was, from my view, a kind of almost a desperation to be successful.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, about a week and a half ago I was in Washington, D.C. to present at a National Juvenile Justice Mentorship Forum. We have Big Brothers Big Sisters is really expanding the use of mentors in juvenile facilities. Mm-hmm. And when I was Superintendent McLaughlin, we started a program a long, long time ago now. And it's really one of the longest running programs of mentorship in a juvenile facility. And I think that's a model not only for Alaska, obviously, but nationally, but to get more mentors that get hooked up with kids while they're still in the facility and then continue on those natural supports that they become. you know, when we started our mentor program at McLaughlin, it wasn't very long when I started hearing kids saying, well, can my mentor come? Can my mentor be there? Mm-hmm. They wanted their mentor at graduation. They wanted their mentor. I mean, that, and we use it. We want to continue to expand. Big Brothers Big Sisters has been a great partner with us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Okay, and then if I can, I have just a couple more questions. On the Medicaid expansion question, I mean, this is an issue that we've heard about in other forums. The governor will be at a decision point soon, I guess, in terms of whether or not the state participates in the Medicaid expansion. And you said that the that Medicaid currently doesn't cover incarcerated individuals. I think that includes the correctional system mm-hmm. as well as the detention system. Is that, do you know if that issue is at all playing into the decision on whether or not we participate?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that's not one of the areas that the feds have been, will give up on yet. That they still have that restriction.
So even if we do expand Medicaid, we would...
That wouldn't impact that.
It would not impact that. Okay. And then the other question, if I can, on tribal health care, is the tribal health care system reimbursing the state for the services of Alaska Native youth, or are they involved in any way?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we have, for example, kids at our Bethel Youth Facility, predominantly Alaska Native kids. When they receive health care in the community, they receive tribal health, mm-hmm. and they pay for that service for those kids.
Okay, but then outside of that area, I mean, in
They do in other parts of the state. I think it was
so are
not,
you reimbursed?
Not 100%. They actually just take care of the service. We bring them, okay. the kids to them.
Right. And then my final question was on FASD and the impact of FASD on the kids in your system. Do you have any idea what the percentages are or what the impacts are?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I don't have a percentage for you, but I know it's a significant impact. And we train our staff about FASD, and a lot of the behaviors of kids that have FASD are similar to other issues that we see presented. They have a hard time planning, looking future, generalizing behavior. But there's a large number of our kids that have that issue, and as we've had more clinicians come into our system, it's been very helpful in identifying those that are truly FASD versus, or suspected of FASD versus others.
Barb, on your increment request, I understand pretty simply on page 10 of your $400,000 that the health costs and medical costs are going mm-hmm. up. I understand that. And you've explained fairly well the trauma information care program and trying to expand that and make it work better. Would you talk a little bit more about the other two requests, why we really need to hire another person to do oversight? And then also, you know, a little bit more about the rural coordinator.
Sure. We have the mental health clinician oversight, actually some position we already have hired. We got that funding approved last year. And so this, we're actually asking for continuation funding. And that's a position we called Mental Health Clinician 4. And she supervises now all of our other clinicians statewide. So we're trying to get some statewide consistency about our services and provide better clinical services to the kids that come to us with, say, over 40% of our kids need those clinical services. And they've been a little bit disjointed over the years that we've added them. It was, I think, in 2005 that we had our first clinician hired at McLaughlin, for example, and now we've got six. And so just managing that workload to be more efficient and productive, it's helpful to get a clinical director to help do that.
If you didn't get that funding, what would happen?
The position that we have, the person that's working in that position now, I guess we either have to try to figure out how to continue to pay for that, or else we'd have, you know, I guess we wouldn't have that position.
Does it have an impact if she's not there or he's not there?
I think it'd have a significant impact. We have seen since she's been hired, which hasn't been that long, an amazing energy around our services. We're really looking at re-energizing our substance abuse services in a more clinical way and our mental health services. And you have to have somebody that comes to work every day just for that piece to coordinate those 13 positions spread out statewide to really get the impact of that. We're seeing a huge, huge gain already.
Speak same thing on the rural coordinator, please.
Well, again, rural coordinator is a position that we have now had for a couple of years. And this person is our connection with tribal communities, with rural communities. We have seen a connection with rural communities that, frankly, we were not very successful at doing. And as kids transition from our facilities back home, the more we can connect them to those communities, the better. I'm hoping that I'll be able to tell you, maybe even next year, about the impact of that in a real tangible way. Right now I got like anecdotal stuff I can tell you, but part of my issue with data with our division is that I want to be able to tell you this is what it makes a difference doing. I can tell you anecdotally it's done a tremendous work. We've had many conferences at three rural communities last year, in Dillingham, Bethel, and Kotzebue. And the coordination of those with our rural specialists, bringing in people from those little tiny places all around to meet with our probation staff, to develop the connections, so that as kids move in and out of the regional hubs, back to the rural real rural areas, we have so much more understanding about what the kids' needs are as they come and go to us. And it's been very helpful. And without that rural specialist position, those would have never happened.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Don't take this as a criticism. You're using the same standard that everybody who deals with the criminal justice system comes to us with, which is measuring recidivism 2 years out. So what the Department of Corrections does, it's what all of the agencies do. And I guess it'll be money on our part, but you know, as somebody who wants you to succeed and mm-hmm. and understands the difficulties you face with children who come through circumstances that lead them to this kind of behavior, is there any way to measure more than 2 years out? I've always thought 2 years out is not long enough for the Department of Corrections, for youth courts, for the mental health courts, mm-hmm. for your agency. And again, I don't mean to be critical, but 2 years out might be the time it takes to process the next crime. I guess it would take more staff, but what's your answer on whether or not, on why it's only 2 years out that the criminal justice system uses, and whether something could be changed about that?
Representative Gareth, through the chair, it's kind of national standards for juvenile justice to also do this 2 year thing. That's pretty standard, really is the recognized amount. It's certainly a resource issue. At some point you have to say this is our part of this. I think it'd be a fascinating study. And I think it would probably teach us a lot about what happens to kids as they get older and move through. But our resources are really trying to focus on giving the information is, you know, this is what we've kind of landed on, that national standard. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Representative Holmes and Representative Newman have joined us recently, and Vice Chair Newman is chairman of this subcommittee, and I'll turn it back over to him and close out the meeting if you need to.
Okay, our next subcommittee meeting is going to be Friday, February 8th. We're going to be back at the 8:30 a.m. scheduled meeting time. Topic is going to be results-based budgeting, and this is an issue that we're going to be looking at further. I've asked the department, we have a lot of grants that go through here, especially behavioral health grants, and how do we measure those? And this is going to be a continued discussion for this, and we have different volunteers from public safety and corrections that will be working on this, but developing a methodology to do a matrix that measures these and the effectiveness, because I think that's going to be a big part of our budget and what we look at. So with that, if there's no further questions, thank you for your attention.